So basically, you have here a group of this indigenous tribe where there's two members left of this tribe, and they're the only surviving users of this language, but they no longer communicate. And that very often is what happens with siblings, where you have something that theoretically should be a very good relationship. You have individuals living in the same home, primarily living many, many years together. You would expect there to be a very good relationship with them, but unfortunately, you hit adulthood and have many, many cases of people who are no longer on speaking terms with their siblings. I have many, many people in my practice who come as adults, and they no longer speak to their brothers or sisters. And these are religious, non-religious, Jewish, non-Jewish. It's a very common thing when you reach adulthood. A lot of people, especially the non-Jewish clients that I have, were very concerned over the past couple weeks that they had to go for Thanksgiving home and sit around a table with a sibling that they no longer talk to, and how are they going to manage Thanksgiving because of the fact that they don't talk to this brother. Forget uncles and aunts. They definitely broke that relationship many years ago. So what is it really about the sibling relationship that creates such turmoil, and what can we do as parents to try early on when the kids are still young to create some kind of atmosphere that would give them some type of long-lasting relationship? So let me start off by giving you handouts of the talk, and then we'll walk through it. Let me also ask you to fight all the urges that you have to read ahead. So I know I used to do that very often when I was a student, and you really have to fight the urge because you really want to just look ahead and see what's ahead. But if I may ask, if you be so kind to just follow along with me in the slides, so we could actually bring it all together. Okay, but again, if you really, really, you can't fight the urge, there's a term for that. Oh, sorry. You feel free to do that, but ideally, go along with where we're up to. Okay, so allow me to start off, if it's okay with you, to mention briefly that it's not only from a scientific perspective that we find that there's something very crucial about the sibling relationship and how important it actually is and how difficult it is to have a good sibling relationship. Very often, parents are concerned that their siblings are not getting along. You should know that that's the norm. The norm is siblings not getting along. And I'll give you a proof for it, not just from the world of the research in psychology and in practice, but even from our world, the world of the Torah. You see that very much as well. All right, right? You see the interesting relationship between Moshe and Aharon. Now we're leading up to that in the weekly Parsha. It's a very, very interesting situation where the Medrash tells us that the reason Moshe and Aharon got to be who they were, the leaders, and really the cornerstone of what Judaism was about, was because they had a good sibling relationship. And you think about all the previous relationships throughout Bereshit, throughout Bereshis, things didn't really work out. Starting from Cain and Hevel, they killed each other. They literally killed each other, right? And then you follow through and you go to Yitzchak and Yishmael, and a horrible relationship. And Yaakov and Esav, horrible relationship. And Yosef and his brothers, they wanted to kill him. Every generation, horrible, horrible sibling relationships. Until Moshe and Aharon. That's the first relationship where... And they really had the recipe for a horrible relationship. Because think what was going on here. Aharon was the leader of the Jewish people while Moshe was stuck in Midian. And Aharon was the leader of the Jews while they were in Egypt. And suddenly God says to him, you know, your younger brother, he's taking over your job. You'd think that Aharon, the older brother, would beat him up, right? And then they meet. Where do they meet? They meet on Har Sinai. And on Har Sinai is where Moshe is going to get the Torah. You think Aharon would just grab his neck and strangle him. But that's not what he does. The Torah tells us, Vayishakeu, Vayishaklo. He kisses him. He comes to him, and this is the younger brother who's going to take over his position, and he just embraces him. And the Torah is very impressed, and the Midrash is very, very impressed with that relationship that they have. So we see that naturally siblings are not going to get along. The question is, what can we do as parents to try to create an environment that's going to be conducive for a certain positive relationship? So let me go to the next box, overview of the presentation. What we're going to look at here is we're going to focus on why is it important to even have a discussion about positive sibling relationships. Okay, let's say they're not going to have a good relationship. Let them grow up and they'll fight. Big deal. We'll talk about why it's not so simple to do that. Then we'll talk about family atmospheres that contribute to positive sibling relationships. And then we're going to finish with effective intervention when they're fighting. Right? There's many different ways you could approach it. So let's just a general introduction. Close to 90%, even over by now, of Americans, of Western individuals, have some kind of relationship, sibling relationship. So if you look at all kinds, half, step, full, more than 90% of Westerners have siblings. So it's a crucial relationship that we have. Number two, it's the most long-lasting relationship that we have. Think about all the relationships that we have with a spouse, with children, with parents. They're limited by time. parents, eventually they move on. Children, they only come later on in our life. Spouses, you meet them only later in your life. A sibling relationship, most people had a sibling when they were young, and they could have an 80-year relationship with their sibling. It's the longest relationship that we could have. And I'll tell you even more. Not just because it's long, it's important, but also because those who do have a good sibling relationship are doing much, much better throughout childhood, adolescence, adulthood, and the golden years. Research is overwhelming that those who have a good relationship have less depression, less loneliness, higher life satisfaction, higher self-esteem, less drug abuse. When they hit adolescence, they have a much easier time dealing with adolescent years if they have a good sibling relationship, a good support. When they hit middle age and have to deal with transition or the midlife crisis, those who have a close sibling relationship do better with that as well. When they hit the older years in life and they have to deal with successful aging, those who have a close sibling relationship are doing much, much better throughout life. So if we take the time and energy to make sure that our kids have a good relationship, you're giving them a gift that's going to last for 70 years. That kind of support is something that's unmatched by anything else, that sibling relationship. Even more than that, another bullet, siblings can even compensate for other negative relationships. So let's say theoretically your son or daughter doesn't have such good friends in school. Now, obviously, you want them to have friends. It's crucial, especially if they're in elementary school or middle school or high school, for sure. But let's say it's not doing so very well. Studies show that if they have a good sibling relationship, it compensates for the lack of friends. Now, again, you want both, obviously. It's better to have both, without a question, especially when you're kids. But siblings can offer that compensation. More than that, when parents are not in a good mood, we all get into not good moods. It's just part of being life, part of living life. When you're in a bad mood, or let's say even worse than that, if a parent is abusive or if a parent is neglectful, if you have a close sibling relationship, it compensates for that. You're doing much, much better. So throughout life, under many, many circumstances, if you're able to have a close sibling relationship, you're at a much, much greater advantage. Okay? Let's move on to the other piece. Now, although obviously there are other things that are beyond our control that ultimately decides if they have a good relationship or not, our children. Like, for example, gender is a piece, right? So studies show that sisters are the closest relationship. The worst relationship is older brother, younger sister. That's the research clearly shows that, right? The medium relationship is two brothers. So that's beyond our control. So you're right, there are certain things that are in the research, it's called family constellation variables. But you know what? There's nothing I can do about it. And also other things that are like family size. If you have a lot of kids, a lot of children in the house, the relationship suffers a little bit, right? That's ultimately what the literature does seem to indicate. Now, not that there isn't what to do to try to ameliorate that problem, but many, many kids. So then the kids are fighting for mommy and daddy. They're fighting for resources, and there's more competition. Mommy is home after a full day of work, and there's seven kids, and they all want some quality time. Mommy doesn't have time for everyone, or daddy doesn't have time. So there's definitely more tension in larger families. And that's also, in some way, something that we can't really manipulate too much. So what can ultimately we do as parents? Another thing that's also a contributor is just temperament. You know what? Some kids are going to have a harsher temperament. If they take over your mother-in-law, that's the way it's going to be. You're going to have to live with it. So that's also something that you're going to have to just deal with. But at the end of the day, there are clearly things that parents could do that could influence their relationship. Again, it's not the only thing, and that should be like a fine print that I'm gonna throw out there. There's certain things that are beyond our control. But whatever is in our control, let's try to maximize that. So I'm gonna share with you two avenues of what parents could do. One of them is what I refer to as indirect things, and the other is what's called direct things. Let's talk about indirect things. So for example, the first thing is called de-identification. De-identification is when two siblings have a different identity. It's important for each child in the home to have their own identity. Who are they? Are they compared to each other all the time? Oh, you're that one's sister, you're that one's brother. That's not necessarily a good thing, for good or for bad. You want children to develop their own identity at home. Identify what they're good at and compliment them for those things that they're good at. Don't make these comparisons. Comparisons never, never work. I remember when I started seventh grade, the first day of class, the teacher read the roster, and I had the misfortune that my older brother was in his class 7 years before. And my older brother just was not the best student, to say it lightly. And the teacher was reading the roster, and he gets to my name. I remember this like it happened 25 years ago. I'm sitting there, and he gets to my name, and he reads Avidan Milevsky. And he pauses, and he's looking at the paper, Milevsky. And he looks at me, he lifts up from his paper, and he says to me, "Are you the brother of Moshe Aryeh?" And I knew immediately that I'm going to be failing that class. I just immediately, and I hacked it, I said, "Yes." And he looks at me, he looks at me and he goes, I knew I'm done with that class. And sure enough, I failed that class. Meaning he made seventh grade science in school in Israel, in Horeb, where I was living at the time. And it was just an amazing thing where he made that comparison. He assumed I'm going to be a certain way because of my older brother. And he labeled me, and it was just a horrible thing. And not just teachers do that. We as parents do that as well sometimes. We make those comparisons, which are not good for our kids. We have to really be able to identify what our kid is good at and highlight that aspect without the comparisons. You know, sometimes parents like to dress their children identical. I understand it's a very cute thing. It's not necessarily a good thing to constantly be having them to identify the same way. Now, with twins, obviously it's a nice thing to do. At a wedding, you dress them up identical. But there's certain people who constantly are dressing their kids the same. That's one small thing that is indicating to them, you guys are the same, and we're going to constantly compare you. That may not be healthy from a clinical perspective, and the research seems to indicate that it's not a good thing. So de-identify your kids. What this kid is good at, and highlight that. Oh, you're so good at that. And when the other kid, by the way, is listening to you compliment the first child, later on go to that second kid and say, "Hey, I noticed you were smiling nicely when I complimented your older sister. Good job." You got to reinforce that. I mean, because naturally, a younger child hearing you compliment an older child, they're not going to like it. Humans, adults don't like when someone else gets a compliment in front of them. So a sibling, how much more so? If they paused and they were quiet, I'm not even saying, "Oh, good job, older sister." Even if they were just paused and smiled, make sure you reinforce that with them. Last week, we came back from my oldest daughter's PTA meeting at Basiaco, Baltimore. And we came back and we were saying these phenomenal things to our older daughter about what her teacher said. And my younger daughter, who's 10, Tamar, just smiled. There was a little bit of a tension, but she clearly made an effort to smile while we were giving her older sister, 12-year-old Viora, these remarkable accolades about her schooling. And my wife and I noted it to each other, and my wife is also a psychologist, unfortunately, so our kids are really going to have a tough time in life, right? So then later on, we made sure before she went to sleep, "Tamar, we noticed how you smiled when we complimented Leora. That was a beautiful thing to do." So you got to make sure that you de-identify, but you got to understand what the other one is looking at, and you have to really follow up on that. Okay, number two, family warmth. Studies are overwhelming that families that are warmer, overall, just you walk into a home and there's a sense of warmth, there's a sense of closeness, there's a nice way of talking. Those kids are going to have a better relationship. It's clear. They see what's happening in the home. On the other hand, families that are chaotic, and there's yelling, and there's phones ringing, and just loud, a loud home that doesn't feel very comfortable and warm, siblings are not going to have a good relationship in those kind of homes. So again, this is an indirect thing. It's not you intervening when your kids are fighting. It's an indirectly creating an atmosphere at home that's conducive for warmth and just a sense of openness and a relationship overall. Siblings in those families are going to have a better relationship. It's very, very clear. Now, what do I mean by family warmth? So having family dinners around the table, right? So now we have that by default once a week, which is phenomenal. But the more you could have that during the week where the family sits down for family time dinner, and that's very difficult in scheduling and everything, but research is overwhelming. Families that have family dinner around the table, their kids have a better relationship. And there are many other phenomenal outcomes of depression issues, loneliness, self-esteem, better in terms of better psychological well-being if you have that kind of sense of warmth. Another thing that is an indirect influence is what kind of relationship we have with our spouse. Our kids look at that and determine how do relationships go. Right? What's the first relationship that your kids notice? It's your relationship with your spouse. So they're going to look at that and they're going to use that as a model for all future relationships. How do my parents interact? How do they fight? How do they love each other? That's going to be how I'm going to do relationships. That's their model. They're going to follow that with your kid within their relationship with siblings. So for example, what kind of style do you engage with your husband or wife when you're fighting? So there's three general styles. Marriage and family therapy highlights three styles of how we fight with our spouse. Some of them are called the avoiders. The avoiders just never talk about problems at home. You know there's an issue with your spouse. No, we don't talk. Let's just sweep it under the rug. We don't talk about it. We smile. No, it's okay. I didn't get offended when you said that the dress doesn't look nice on me. Or I didn't get offended when you said that I work too hard. And they just never deal with clearly painful emotions between the spouses, and they just don't deal with it. Kids pick up on that. That, hey, whenever there's a problem, it's just, we're not going to talk about it. That's the avoiders. The second type are fighters. Fighters are the fighters. It's a couple that really yells at each other, and there's loudness, and they reprimand, and they minimize, and again, kids are seeing that and saying, oh, that's how you fight. Okay, I'll do that with my brothers and sisters. Or the third type, which is the ideal type, are the communicators. They sit down. I disagreed. I'm sorry when I said that. There's that openness in terms of communicating. You have a problem. Now, some of this you don't want to do in front of your kids, obviously. That's a very definitive suggestion coming from the literature on parenting. But some of that you do want to do in front of your kids. Show them how to fight. Show them how disagreements are dealt with. Again, I know what we're very often parents are, nothing in front of the kids. The kids shouldn't see any aspect of our relationship. I know the previous generation was big believers. My grandparents were big believers in that. The kids shouldn't see any aspect of the relationship that exists between the husband and wife. Why? They're going to learn from that relationship how to have relationships. They're going to learn from that how to have conflict. That's what they're going to learn. So if you're saying, no, I'm not going to let my kids see any way or any kind of a relationship that exists between us, how are they going to know how to fight? So every once in a while, now again, not all of them, most of them do happen in our bedroom, the discussions, but when you're sitting around a table and there is, seep into some kind of exchange where, oh, you were right, I was sorry, I said that and that was offensive. Let kids see that when relationships are not going well, how to deal with it. How are your kids going to know how to fight? They will know based on how you fight, quote, with your spouse. If you use the right way by communicating, they're going to perceive that message. And then the next time their older brother does something to them, they're not going to sweep it up under the rug. They're not going to be avoiders. They're not going to fight. They're not going to yell and minimize. They say, hey, you know what? You offended me. You took that. I didn't like that. Where do they learn that from? From the way you fight with your spouse. Okay? And the way you talk also. Do you say, I'm sorry? Do you say, you're right? How do kids know to use these language, right? They know that from the way you talk with your spouse, right? So these are indirect ways in which kids learn about how to engage their siblings. But now let's talk about direct influences. The next slide. And we have over here copies for those who came a little late, pass them around. Let's talk about indirectly. So we're up to the fifth box, the fifth slide. Okay, what about direct ways? What does it mean, direct ways? Direct ways is how do you actually go in there and manipulate the relationship? Now, that is primarily seen when they fight. Kids are fighting. What are you going to do about it? So let's talk about sibling fighting. When they're actually fighting now, what should parents be doing when kids fight? So first of all, the first thing we have to understand is that fighting is going to happen. Not only is it going to happen, but it's an important thing to happen. So very often parents come to me and they're very nervous that their kids are fighting. No, kids fighting is actually a good thing. Now, obviously, there's a border, and we'll talk about that. But what does it mean that kids are fighting? We very often think that kids are fighting, they hate each other. That's not necessarily the case. And let me give you a little story to illustrate this idea. Many years ago, when I was in graduate school, over the weekends to pay for graduate school and supplement a little income that I had from an assistantship at the school, I worked over the weekends as a youth director at a shul down in Miami. I went to school in Miami. And my job was that on Shabbos, I would be in charge of organizing groups for the kids. And I had teenagers, NCSY teenagers, who would run the programs for me. And I would have to just go from group to group to make sure that everyone's doing the right thing. So there was this one Shabbos that I'm walking around, and a teenager runs up to me and says, I need you to come immediately to my group. There's a massive fight going on there. You need to immediately take care of it. So I run up the steps. I go into the room with the four-year-old, five-year-old group. And there are two boys on the floor punching each other. One of the kids, the four-year-old, had blood coming down his nose. Really getting into a real fight. The worst problem was that these two kids were brothers. And even worse than that was that these were the two sons of the rabbi of the shul. That was the real worst part. So I don't know. So I tried to break them up a little bit. It was not going. These kids were engaged in a heavy fight. So I decided to run downstairs and call the rabbi and say, hey, you know what, your kids are upstairs. I don't know what to do about it. So I run downstairs and I get to the shul, and unfortunately the rabbi was in the middle of his speech. He was in the middle of his Shabbos brush up. And I'm standing, should I disturb the rabbi during this drasha? The kids are fighting, blood is being shed up there, but the first clause of my contract was don't disturb the rabbi during his speech. Like, what am I going to do? I say, you know what, I'm not going to let the blood spill, I'm going in there. So I walk down the aisle and everyone's looking like, what is he doing? I go up to the rabbi and I whisper in his ear, your kids are in a violent fight upstairs, I need you to come help me. And the rabbi is all upset and he's begrudgingly leaves and everyone's wondering what happened out there. And the rabbi goes and I chase after him, he runs up the stairs, goes into the room, and as we get there, the kids are still punching each other. And he goes in there, and it was very clear at that moment where their kids got their violent tendencies from. He goes in there, grabs the kids by the back of their sleeve, picks them up, drags them out to the hallway, puts them down. The four-year-old has blood coming out of his nose. The four-year-old, five-year-old is all ripped up, and he starts yelling at his kids in a voice that's reserved for Rabbanim. Like, he was giving it to them, and there's... So I grabbed a bottle of water. I had a little bottle of water, and I was going to give it to the four-year-old to replenish some of the blood that he was losing. So I hand the bottle to the four-year-old, and this is what the kid does. The kid takes the bottle, wipes with the sleeve the blood, drinks, and hands it to his brother. And the brother takes it like the most natural thing and drinks it. 2 minutes after they almost killed each other, they were sharing the water. And at that point, it hit me. And it was during that time where I was trying to figure out what am I going to do research on for my dissertation. It was that moment that I said, this is what I need to study. I need to study how can two kids go from punching each other and blood coming out of his nose to sharing the bottle of water. And when I delved into the literature and I started practicing many years later, I realized that they're not mutually exclusive. Kids can punch each other in the nose and love each other. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And I constantly do these little questions and experiments with my kids just to have what to discuss in class. And recently after dinner, my older brother, my Uzi, my older son, had a toy, and my younger son, Matityahu, wanted the toy from him. So he goes and he hits the 7-year-old brother and he takes the toy. So I turn to my 4-year-old, Mati, and I say to him, Mati, do you love your brother or do you hit your brother? And he says, both. I love him and I hit him. So a 4-year-old grasps this concept very simply. You could do both. It's not mutually exclusive. I think it's an important thing for us as parents to understand that. That number one is, I'll use a scientific term, let's not freak out when our kids get into fights. It's a normal, now why is it a normal thing?
And they keep research, on saying, I'm sorry, because I hate you.
Oh, so now there are exceptions. Yeah, we'll deal with that exception. There definitely is an exception to that, which we'll get to. But overall, you're normative fighting. And you're right, there is a point where it's beyond normative already. And maybe they really do hate each other. But that usually is involved with other risks in the family. There are other problems in the family, much more pervasive. Your standard fighting between siblings is a way for them to learn how to exchange ideas. How to get into, right? Again, how do they know how to engage exchanges? How do they know where you hit someone, there's a consequence? What's his opinion? They learn that from fighting with their siblings. And literature does show that if you have that microcosm of siblings and you engage them in the right way, you're more likely to have better friend relationships. So you take what you learned with your siblings and you transfer it to your friends as well. So it's a crucial, crucial part of learning how to engage others. So therefore, it's not a sign of hate. It's a sign of passion. What most concerns me is when I work with siblings and they come in and they don't look at each other. And one kid says something horrible to his brother, and it means nothing to the brother. It's like he doesn't even respond to it. That's when I know there's no emotion there anymore. And the same thing when I work with couples. When a couple comes to my office for marriage counseling, and they sit on opposite sides of the couch, and they can say the most hurtful things, and it doesn't seem to faze the other person, then you know that we're in trouble. When they are fighting, and they get into each other, and what did you say? That means there's some passion there. It's okay, we have to obviously do something. We're not going to... Good job, guys. You could go ahead and leave. Right? Because obviously you have to work on that, but that means there's passion in the relationship. Same thing, right? So that's clearly coming from marriage and family counseling when it comes to marital relationships. When it comes to siblings, it's the same deal. When they ignore each other, that's when you know it's more pervasive. When they're fighting, that means there's passion between them. Okay, now, what about intervening? That's a big question. Kids are fighting. What do we do? Do we go in there? Do we stop the fighting? What are the different options? So what I would like to do now is I want to give you a quick little intervention style assessment. This is a measure that I put together and published in several places, drawn from some other literature on siblings. And it's basically going to ask you about what you do when your kids fight. just to get an idea a little bit of what we're dealing with, and then you'll see the options, and then we'll talk about which is better. So take a few moments, read the question, and then answer these seven simple items, and then we'll talk about what they categorize into and which one is more beneficial. All right, let me explain what these items are. And it's always interesting when we have, I'm assuming you're a couple down there. It's always interesting when you have different answers from the father and the mother. There's a whole other area of research on that aspect, meaning which one is more important. We're not going to get into that today, but it's definitely something to follow up on. But basically, as you may have already noticed from these seven items can be categorized into three styles of intervention. And literature, there isn't a lot of work, believe it or not, from all the relationships out there that we have, the sibling relationship has the least scientific literature. There's more research on our relation with our mother-in-law than there is research on siblings. Who would want to do that kind of research, right? But the sibling relationship, there isn't a lot out there in terms of the scientific literature on siblings. So this is being drawn in terms of these three categories. The little that is out there, literature seems to categorize parents into three types of intervention. And we're now, in our university, are engaged in a research study to try to get a larger sample. A lot of these samples are not a representative sample. They don't represent cross-religion, so we're trying to do this in the Jewish community as well. But literature indicates three styles of intervention. The first style is what's called the non-involvement. So I'll tell you what the styles are, and then I'll show you where you scored, and then you'll know if you're on the right track or you have to shift your approach a little bit. Non-involvement are those who just don't get involved. They ignore it, take care of yourself, leave me alone. It's your business, I don't care. That's the non-involvement. So they're actively not involved in the decision. Number two is coaching. The coaches get down on the level of the kids, and they coach. They teach them how to fight. Hey, you know what? And we'll talk soon a little bit about what's the exact ways of engaging coaching. But coaching ultimately is about going down there and teaching them how to fight. What did he say? What did you say? Why did he say it? You're teaching them how to have a relationship. Kids are not going to learn automatically. How are they going to know that I'm not allowed to punch him because he took something? Why not? I don't know. My nature wants me to do that. So how do I know if he has something I want it? How do I know how to get it? So you have to teach your kids. You have to teach them how to actually teach them how to fight, teach them how to communicate. That's the coaches. And there are parents who do that. Every single fight, they get down on the level. Okay, what happened? They go through the process. That's number two. The third type are those who are called those who are intervening. What it means, they intervene. They go in there and they break up the fight. Right? So the non-involvement, you're on your own. Coaching, they explain. Those who intervene are like a helicopter that swoops down, takes care of the problem, and leaves. So they either punish them immediately. I don't care who did what. You go to your room. You go to your room. Let's not talk about it. That's just without engaging in how to communicate. Or they go in there and they punish immediately. Okay, now you know, recess, or you're not in class, but whatever you have as a parent. Playing a video game if you have video games at home. Or you're not having dessert because you were fighting during the meal. Immediate fighting without finding out what really happened here. Those who are, they come in, they swoop in, they intervene. Now, going back to your style that you put for yourself, the first two items are those, obviously, that we would consider non-involvement. So if you ignore the problem or you tell them to work it out themselves, so if you scored 4 or 5, so if your average, let's say, 8, 9, or 10 on the first two items, you score high on non-involvement. All right, so you can note to yourself that if you did a 4 or 5 on both of them, even a 3 on one of them and a 5 on the other, that's a high score of non-involvement. If you scored very low on that, if you have a 1 or 2 on both of those, you're not really using non-involvement as a consistent pattern.
It's 2 on average.
Then you're average, and you can have that also. You can have people who are average a little bit. 2 on both, that means you're on the lower end of that. It means that's not really your style. Number 3 and 4 is the style of coaching. Those are the number 3s. I give them advice, or I explain their siblings' feelings to them. That's a coacher. So again, if you scored high on that, you're considered a coacher. So if you did a 4 or 5 on that, that's a high coaching strategy. 1 or 2 is you don't really use coaching very much. 5 and 6, I step in and solve the problem, I punish them. Those are what we would call those who intervene. They break up the fight, right? They're the punishers. If you score 4 or 5 on those items, on 5 and 6, you are considered more of those who get involved in intervening with punishing. 1 and 2 are, that's not really your style. And finally, I ask my husband to handle the problem. Which one do you think that is?
Taking it off of your shoulder.
Right, that's a non-involvement. That number 7 goes back to 1 and 2.
Well, maybe
so
not enough.
You really, for 1 and 2, For one and two, you have to combine seven. So really, those who really are non-involvers are, you have to look at your average of one, two, and seven. Meaning, go to your father when he comes home. That means you're just not getting involved. Or go to your mother, she's in charge of that part of our family. That means you're not an involver, right? So they're sure they're constellation involved, for sure. There's that. That could be a whole other series of lectures about that dynamic in there.
Between a certain child and myself, or a child and my husband, and he had a better relationship.
Depending on which one, yeah. For sure. You definitely do find that. You definitely do find
sometimes
that.
Sometimes you feel like, to be honest, it's ignoring, but you feel like what you're doing is not working, so it's like,
all right, so let's go through the suggestion, then we'll see how that corresponds to what's going on. Let's move on to the next page, page number two, the other side. All right, so now let's look at, we spoke about the three types: those who don't get involved, those who coach, and those who punish. Which one is most appropriate? So literature seems to tell us that it depends on how old the kids are. So our initial approach is obviously coaching for all ages. The studies show that it's not so clear. Let's look at the differences. When you have younger children, and when I say younger, again, there's not a lot of research on this, and I'm basing this on the little bit of research that's out there, the research that I've conducted, and the work that I do with siblings in my practice. Younger kids are 10, 11, below 10, 11. By the time kids hit 12, they reach a new mental state, and that's coming from the father of mental development, Piaget, that at 7, you really move on to a new way of thinking, and you could really let them go a little bit. Before 11, 10, that's like each kid obviously is a bit of an individual, but if I have to give you a general stage, 10, 11, 12 is when you have to start shifting of how you're dealing with your kids. If they're below that, you have to do coaching. They're little kids, they don't know how to communicate, they don't know how to fight, they don't know how to disagree. So what do? So coaching younger children, clearly, what's involved? Number one, don't ask who started it. It's a big mistake that parents fall into. Who started it? You're going to go through an hour deliberation in front of the Supreme Court. You're never going to get to the answer. I've never found a parent who really got to the final answer. Who started it? We got, ladies and gentlemen, the jury. He's the guilty one. There's no such thing who started it. That's never going to reach somewhere positive. Number two, start with cool down period. As we know ourselves, when you're angry and your spouse comes and starts being rational with you, it just doesn't work. It's just like, calm down and find the right time and then start engaging in discussion. But you know, when you did that, such and such. Same thing when it comes to siblings. Right after they finish punching each other, their heart rate is so elevated that there's no processing in the prefrontal cortex, or very little. It's all emotional. It's all limbic system, amygdala kind of activation, which is the emotional center of the brain. You can't start talking to them about, okay, what do you think? What did he think? What did he do? They're not ready for that. They're just in that emotional, primal kind of response. Take a few minutes. Let them calm down. Okay, now let's start talking. Ask what happened. And make sure you get both perspectives. And it's a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, or a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. Each one, okay, hang on. Now he's going to tell me what happened. And he starts and the other one jumps in. Hang on again. He's talking now. I promise you I'm going to give you a moment to talk. And how do your kids know that you really are going to let them talk? Because last time they saw that it really worked. You got to do this consistently. You can't let the 7-year-old manipulate the conversation, and you promise the 4-year-old that he's going to get his turn to talk about what happened, and you never get to it because the 7-year-old just convinced you and you moved on and you were busy. You really got to make sure you go back to the 4-year-old so that he in the future knows, I really am going to get a turn to talk over here, so I'm going to keep quiet now so the 7-year-old can tell his story. You're done? Okay, is there anything else you want to say? Okay, what do you say happened over here? And you let, and again, the 7-year-old is going to jump in. Hang on, you got a chance to talk. That's just basic communication. Kids don't know that naturally, that you talk first, I'm quiet, then a lot of adults don't necessarily know that. But it starts from teaching at a very young age. Okay, he finished. Okay, next step is, what could you have said differently? Being, let them learn that there are other routes to what happened in the fight. You wanted this and you went there. Okay, that was one way. What could you have done a little bit differently? And you let them think. Even a 4-year-old can answer this question. Even a 4-year-old can answer, obviously not at the same level as a 7-year-old answering it, but they both could come up with other alternatives. Okay, instead of doing that, I could have done this. That's a great option. What else? Now, a 4-year-old may not be able to come up with 2-3 options. A 7-8-year-old may, yes, be able to come up with a few options. But you got to show them that what they did is not the only way to deal with this problem. And show them that they could come up with the solutions themselves. You're right. You could have said to him, I would like to play with this. You could have said to him, don't sit on my bed. You could have said to him, read my book, or please don't do that, or let me do it and then you'll do it next. But instead, you went and hit them. Show them that there are other options of how to deal with the problem. Another thing is, don't require a forced apology. It's also something that we very quickly do as parents. Apologize. Imagine that as an adult, if someone did something bad and someone, you have to apologize. You're teaching a kid that apologies are not sincere. When you really got into a fight with someone and someone just comes down and forces you, apologize means it makes no difference if you really feel a sense of regret. Just say it from your mouth and we're in business. That's you're forcing an apology on a kid. It does not work that way. Apology means it's something that's internal. You really feel it. So what you should tell your kids is, when you feel sorry, or go and think, when you feel sorry, you could apologize. You're teaching them, again, it's not always going to work, but you're teaching them that, hang on, saying I'm sorry is just a word. And when I use words, it represents something much deeper on the inside. Again, kids don't know that. We have to teach them in order to raise emotionally healthy kids. What is words? Words are associated with emotions. When you feel it, go say I'm sorry. Another thing we have to be careful is when we intervene that we're not picking favorites. And we all have to admit, and although we don't like to admit this in public, we do have kids that we like better than others. And I'm sorry for saying it, but don't quote me on this. But at the end of the day, every parent, not I don't say every parent, but the literature is overwhelming on this, that we do in some ways, I don't know if you want to say like one kid more than the other, but substitute another word for we like them. We do have favorites in certain ways, and it changes also. So they're doing a little bit better, and they're giving you less of a hard time, and then suddenly they become more of a Ben Zikunin, even though they're not really a Ben Zikunin. And so we have to be honest with ourselves. We don't have to tell people about it, but just in your heart we know. So when you intervene, sometimes subconsciously, we are manipulating things that kid that this week behaved better and was on your better side ends up getting the better deal. So awareness is number one, that are you really being impartial over here to make sure that, because literature is overwhelming. When kids perceive favoritism, that's one of the worst recipes for horrible sibling relationships. Jealousy, right? Just look at the total. Look at the entire voracious. When siblings are jealous of each other, it doesn't end up very, very well. So we got to be very careful with that favoritism. Now, what happens when kids are a little bit older? When kids are a little bit older, they don't always appreciate parents swooping in and taking care of their problems. Meaning by now, you've taught them for a good few years while they were kids how to fight. Now, let them test it out on their own. See, are they ready now to go into the real world and practice what you've been teaching them since day one? So now they're 10 or 11, and you make a rule, you make it clear to them. You make it clear to them that when you guys fight, you're going to have to be in charge of this, right? You tell them, work it out. And you have, when you hear a fight, you even yell it out, work it out, meaning they know that that's like the party line of this family. When you're fighting and they're above 10, you're going to work it out. However, you do have to have some kind of cautious involvement. So for example, you could have certain guidelines, meaning you guys are going to work it out. And you have to have like a family meeting about this, or what I encourage parents to do is establish a family constitution. I have families get together, family meetings, yes, just like the olden days, there's actually effectiveness to this. And you establish a family constitution, and you hang it up on the fridge. And there are very clear markings about what's permitted and what's not. One of the clauses of this family constitution is when there's fighting, and again, it depends on the age of the kids, you're going to work it out. However, you have to have two guidelines, volume and violence. How loud does it get? At some point, if it reaches a certain point, I'm going to intervene. And violence, you know, that's a decision you have to make. Are you willing to go with a shoving or a pushing or rumbling on the floor? Again, ideally, obviously, you want to have some kind of line that's very definitive. The only line that you could have is when there's physical contact. Meaning, so you could punch him in the head, but not in the stomach. Or it's very hard to make that line. You got to have a line. The line should be there's no physical violence. Why? Because as adults, that's not going to fly. So I only hit you once, and I could have hit you another time. So you got to prep them for the real world. In the real world, you can't use physical violence. So yes, 12-year-olds want to hit. They're natural. Maybe they see it in school. At an hour home, the term is you hit, you sit. There is going to be a consequence. Touch, you do not touch. That's one of the guidelines you put in there. But how do we work it out? Okay, you're going to work it out. You're old enough. You've learned these things early on. But you do not. Physical violence is out. Okay? I'm going to hold the questions for the end. That works so we can get through, and then we'll revisit that. Okay? Next, calm intervention when needed. Very often you decide, okay, that's it. They've reached that point. You're going to go in. You're going to swoop in, and you become loud. And you may even become physical yourself by grabbing a kid. they're going to learn that, and you're yelling at them as you're like pushing the kids away or moving. You say, no hitting, and while you're hitting your kid, you're yelling, no hitting. I've seen that. You have, no, hang on, what are you teaching your kids? So when you come in there to finally intervene, when they've reached that guideline, when they've reached that threshold, you do it in a very calm fashion. Again, we could deal with this in a calm way. So you don't go in there, you don't respond to violence with violence. Age difference responsibilities. We do have to be honest with the fact that older kids do have more of a responsibility on this one. And that's part of the discussion you have with them before they're fighting. So when you do the family constitution, you also make it clear that, you know, you are older, and I'm going to expect a little bit more thinking on your part. The older kids should do understand that they do have more of a responsibility. Now, not to say that every single fight is on them, but in terms of navigating it, you do indicate to them that you're older and you're going to have more of a responsibility. I'm going to listen to both sides, but you're older over here. Also, keep in mind one more thing, and that's the final bullet of that slide. Girls and social aggression. We always are very easy to intervene when siblings fight the way boys fight. And we right again, there's research on this. I'm not being stereotypic. There's clear research that boys fight more physically. Girls fight more socially. I mean, girls have a way of being much more destructive and painful without having to even punch once. And there's research on this from the playground all over in terms of bullying, where, I don't know, a boy punches another boy, it hurts for 10 minutes, and you move on and you continue. When girls fight in their social, indirect way, you could be 20 years later and you could remember that third grade girl who said something to you. Now you're 40 and you still hate her and you're not going to school reunions because you're going to bump into her because 25 years ago she said something to you. There's that social kind of brewing process. And again, we used to think that was a stereotype, but it's not. There's research on this that it's called indirect aggression, social aggression. It's the difference between coming at someone with like a sword versus an arrow. A sword, you know who's hitting you. An arrow, you have no idea why people are alienating suddenly now and why your friends are responding differently because someone's spreading a rumor. Right? That's a very common process in schools. At homes, it could be very, very similar, especially when I have a few siblings. So you get the older sister to, you know what she did? You know what she told mommy? So the girls have a way of like creating like this undercurrent in the home to alienate that other sibling. Or that's very destructive. And we have to keep in mind that that's fighting also. That needs to be tended to. We don't usually, as parents, do that. We usually respond when there's punching, the boy kind of fighting. And girls could also do boy kind of fighting. But overall, but when there's girl kind of fighting, that indirect rumor spreading, that's much more destructive, right? When you punch, you do boy fighting, there's a black and blue eye. Girl fighting, unfortunately, eventually leads to eating disorders. Yeah. It's that kind of undercurrent pressure. And again, research seems to indicate this, that girl fighting is much, much more destructive than you punch me, you move on with life. So as parents, keep in mind that your sibling, your kids may be engaging this kind of social indirect aggression. Okay, let's wrap it up. Summary. Consistency is key. It's very easy to have a top 10 list of what you're going to do with your kids, and you do it and that's it. You've got to make sure you're consistent with it. System-wide approach. It's very difficult to take one piece of advice and I'm going to do this and it's going to change. If we really want to change the way our kids engage each other, you got to take it from all these different approaches. Change the atmosphere in your home. Change the way you engage your spouse. Also intervene differently. One little sticker, and I have it so often, I have parents coming to my office, we go through this whole process and examples, and they pick one thing that we did in session, and they apply, they come back, I did it, it didn't work. Yeah, you took one bullet from the 50 things that we spoke about in the entire system. It's very, very, again, as we started with, siblings are going to fight. It's a natural thing. If you want to change, Band-Aids never work, not just when it comes to siblings, any parenting tip. Oh, I read a tip that I should be doing this and it's going to work. That the really shifts in parenting require a system-wide approach to really influence change in the life of your kids. Communication throughout the family. How do you communicate? How do you communicate on the phone? But how do you communicate with your friends, with in-laws? How do you communicate with your spouse? Kids are perceiving that. Approach intervention cautiously, as we said, particularly with older kids. Don't just swoop in. If they're a bit older, they don't want you to get involved. They may be able to work it out themselves. Prove to them that they could work it out themselves. And finally, parenting is a long-distance marathon. Remember that we may do all these things with our kids, and a week later we don't see results. Ah, that's it, it's not working. Like anything in parenting, it's work day in, day out, day in, day out, so that when they're 19, 20, 21, 22, you may find some results. Now, not that you don't see momentary, once a month or every other week, something that's phenomenal in terms of their relationship. I'm like, wow, that was beautiful. That's going to happen. But we have to remember that parenting is long term. You work, you work, you work, you work, and you're not going to see results in 1 week. But you apply this. The goal ultimately is that when they reach that point, when they move on with life, you really gave them the tools to really create a better life for themselves. What we spoke about today comes from one of my chapters in my book. Actually, it's available almost everywhere, and I just got a recent email, interestingly, from Iran. Supposedly, it's not available in bookstores in Iran. That's what I just got an email from some person. My daughter commented that he couldn't afford it, but he has an iPad. That was her thought. You have my information on the bottom there. Allow me to end with a quote by James Boswell. He was an 18th century author. Beautiful quote about siblings. I, who have no sisters or brothers, look with some degree of innocent envy on those who may be said to be born to friends. Very, very beautiful comment. And I think David Amel said it even better. Kinei matov u'manayim shevet achim gam yachad. The Midrash tells us that that's referring to Moshe and Aaron and the relation that they had. So hopefully we can apply this and have our kids have that kind of relationship that's lacking of jealousy and really creating an atmosphere in the entire home that's conducive for well-being. Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah, so I love the idea of coaching. I think I tend to either go with the non-involvement or the school community.
The intervention.
Intervention. Just because I just don't go any other way. It's just so hard. Like, one is screaming.
It's true. It requires time.
This
sure.
one did this. This one did that.
It's much quicker to just go in there, punish, and this party's over. But if you want to foster a long-term relationship, it's going to require time. And coaching takes more time. You have to get down there, and you're in the middle of cooking, and the phone's ringing, and you got seven things going on. Stop everything, and it may take 5-10 minutes to really navigate that.
I'm very excited to use it, but you also with the you said it was more with older kids, but what about with younger kids?
It's gonna happen. I mean, it's hard to have guidelines with a 5-year-old because they're much more impulsive.
My kids hit.
If they're 5, it's gonna happen. So you go in there, you coach them. Once they're hitting 11, 12 already, they have more control over their emotional brain. Now they're not totally in control until they're 20, unfortunately, right? And research is showing us that the frontal lobe is not fully developed until you're 20, 21. So it's going to happen that they're going to have an impulsive kind of thing, but they're a bit more in control. So that's why it's a guideline for later on when they're 5, they're going to hit, and that's when you come in and you navigate that kind of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
All right.